This is a podcast from Consilio. We bring people together to create better places.
Hello, and welcome to Better Places from me, Nathan Parsad, in London.
And me, Luke Francis, in sunny Spain. It's too hot, actually.
Very sunny Spain.
Way too hot. It's ridiculous.
How is it?
Roast it. It's lovely. It's I'll show you. In fact, here you go. Let me turn my. This is nothing for the podcast.
This is going to be nothing for the people listening to this.
Yeah,
but
nice.
It looks sunny and green.
It will be a test to anyone who listens to this. We'll have a screenshot of that available for anyone who wants to see what the apartment in Spain looks like.
Drop an email, lfrancis@consilio.com, and he'll be more than happy to send you a copy. But anyway, less about Luke's holiday and more about what's going on here and on this episode. So this is the last episode. I guess this will be our last one before summer, really, before we wrap up for 6 weeks. But it's been a while since we've done one anyway. But we're back. And what are we talking about today? We've got a couple of fantastic guests. We've got Councillor Jeff Barraclough and Councillor Tim Rocker from Westminster City Council on the podcast. I was there at City Hall this afternoon recording it. So it's all pretty much hot off the press. And it was quite good. Had an update on various policies, but also this overall mission that Westminster are trying to achieve through their Fairer Westminster strategy, which was really interesting, actually. And clearly they are an administration in a hurry. So, it was a good chat. What else? What's been going on, Luke? Let's talk about what's happening politically.
Well, all sorts. I mean, it's been, as I said, it's been a little while since we last recorded one of these. I think from a Labour perspective, it's all getting very serious now, isn't it? And a little bit testy. Keeps out this weekend again, talking about, amongst other things, planning reform. Increasingly we're seeing a Labour Party nationally that doesn't want to be making any uncosted spending commitments, and reform seems to be the order of the day, and sort of chief among those, planning. We're seeing lots around housing from the Labour Party at the minute. I think we've mentioned before that the Leader's Office see housing and housing delivery as a central theme that runs through their five key missions. But it's going to be interesting to see how long they can hold the line of existing spending commitments and just looking at reform.
Well, it's interesting that because of this ironclad commitment, I mean, they're determined not to be attacked for fiscal discipline, right? Or for being reckless with the nation's finances. And you can understand that completely. I mean, look, we saw what happened last year when governments make unfunded spending commitments, markets lose faith, becomes very difficult to borrow money overall. And seeing as we are borrowing money to fund expenditure at the moment, I can understand why they feel they need to be fiscally responsible. I think the challenge with that is, will the party take it? Because, you know, we've already seen in the last few days in relation to the benefit child cap that there's some ructions in the party about, you know, what is a Labour government for if it's not to reverse things like this. So I understand the position of the leadership, but I think clearly that's causing some tensions internally. But also, is it believable? Because I think most people probably would think that they would reverse policies like that, which would cost money, which would lead to different spending commitments, if not borrowing. But nonetheless, at the moment, they would rather be talking about reform, for sure. And I get that. And actually, what that's leading to, as you point out, Luke, is a real conversation about planning. I mean, Keir Starmer was on the Sunday shows this weekend and had a piece in The Observer, effectively saying, look, we won't spend any more money, we'll go for reform. And, you know, what that looks like is going to be interesting, but planning is a big part of it. And it seems to me he is very much pushing to be seen to be the person who is going to reform planning and get Britain building again, which is a good message for the electorate, to be honest.
And it'll be an interesting one as well. So we've got the MPF coming up, so the National Policy Forum for the Labour Party, which I think is maybe this weekend. And for the uninitiated, this is the forum in which the Labour Party brings together elected representatives, so MPs, but also sort of councillors, member representatives from all of their various constituency Labour parties and trade unionists as well, to thrash out some of the policies that as a collective movement the Labour Party would like to see in the next manifesto. And, you know, it will be very interesting to see what comes out of that in terms of planning and development policy. Because, you know, the Labour Party have put some big policy statements out there through Lisa Nandy, the Shadow Levelling Up Secretary. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see where particularly the Labour Party membership and the trade unions are on these issues, and whether they'd like to see the Labour Party going further, you know, how they respond to some of the things that have come out of Keir Starmer's office and his interviews over the last couple of weeks. They aren't binding. So what comes out of the MPF discussions doesn't automatically go into the manifesto, but it will certainly give you an indication of where, as a movement, the Labour Party are. And as you say, you know, how much of this is a bit of a Trojan horse to get through the door at number 10 and then start implementing some more radical policies and maybe a bit more of a comprehensive spending agenda.
Yeah.
But, you know, trust and particularly economic trust at the moment and has always been a massive issue for the Labour Party. And we know it's one of the main reasons that the Labour Party struggled to win elections historically. So we'll see. It'll be interesting.
Yeah. I mean, also, I think both major parties are now getting to the point where, you know, I think everyone broadly expects the election to be October 24, possibly later, possibly earlier, but I think the expectation is it's October 24, which means we're kind of, you know, once you get past summer, we're into the 12-month march to a general election, basically.
Yeah.
And I suspect conference season will kick that off in earnest. But, you know, there's set to be a government reshuffle before then. So Rishi's quite keen, as I understand, to get his top team out there and get his election team ready. And so that's going to require some changes. And I presume that Keir Starmer's planning something similar to get an election ready reshuffle if all of the leaks over the last few weeks are to be believed. So there may be some changes just in character as well as that developing policy position.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It'll be an interesting couple of weeks to see where both sides land and they're readying their teams to go out and do battle over the next 12 months.
Well, the other thing is, you know, it's like, I think 48 Conservative MPs are stepping down in the next election, right? Some of those
big names.
Well, Ben Wallace as the Defence Secretary, although he was displaced in boundary changes, he's decided not to seek another seat. So he'll be stepping down as Defence Secretary in the autumn, but then as an MP next year. So, you know, that's obviously a big gap to fill in the cabinet, particularly in the context of Ukraine. But there will be other people who are maybe not household names, but semi-household names, if you like, who will undoubtedly start stepping down. So that presents, you know, other challenges to get the, you know, the talent into the top team ahead of the next election.
Well, so we've not even talked about the by-elections on Thursday.
No, I know. I'll come to that in a minute. But just briefly, it's because all three of them are going to be a complete disaster. So I think it'll be what Labour 2, Lib Dems 1, Conservatives 0. but let's see. Look, I don't, at the risk of sounding like a cabinet minister doing a broadcast round, by-elections historically offer virtually no insight into how the elections follow thereafter. But it will provide a snapshot of sentiment, as if we needed any more evidence that the country's decided, you know, London in 22, the local elections this year. The by-elections will just be the latest in a sea of anyone but the Conservatives, I think. So, but we'll see. Maybe I'll be wrong and ULEZ will cause Danny Bill some difficulty over in Uxbridge. And that Conservative core vote up in Selby may stay, but I don't know. I think it's tough. So I think it's unlikely. What I was interested in, though, is Michael Gove, and, you know, he is seen as a great reformer in the Conservative circles. He's seen as somebody who is a thinker, who wants to get stuff done, famously took on education when he was Education Secretary, but has a history of seeking to reform things. And that's one of the reasons he was originally given the levelling up brief by Boris. I think, you know, he's obviously caused massive conflict with the development industry, and you know there's loads of tension there. The M&S decision is expected imminently. It may even be out by the time you listen to this podcast. But there's lots of antagonistic, I suppose, sentiment behind Gove and what he's been doing. That's the perception in the development industry for sure. What I found interesting was that, so we saw there was a Sunday Times article week before last that was all about, you know, okay, what are his planning policies going to be? What's he actually going to do? And there's quite a lot, you know, there was talk about Cambridge becoming, I think it was Europe's Silicon Valley with extra homes and the tram. And there were other reforms he's talking about. So, you know, the nutrient neutrality stuff that's causing chaos in the rest of the country, not so much London. You know, is there going to be a resolution on that? Is there going to be this list of 20 towns and cities that could be redeveloped? And of course, the changes to the MPPF maybe finally being published. So it does feel like we're not going to spend the next year with nothing in terms of revised policy from the government. Because I think there has been this kind of stasis where Rishi took over, got rid of the housing targets. That's caused a load of local authorities to pause local plans, and it's kind of been chaos ever since. I think it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that in the next few weeks. And again, it's this whole thing of, you know, everyone's gearing up for what their election pitch is going to be. And there is going to have to be some detail behind these policies. Lots coming up, really, I suppose.
Yeah, be a busy summer.
But as I say, if you want to see what a Labour administration looks like once it's in action, and I described it in the podcast with Jeff and Tim as it is like a government department, really, Westminster. It's such a big council with so many different stakeholders and so many different things constantly happening. You almost have to treat it as if it is a government department. And you know, certainly the things that they are doing 1 year on from taking control, where they've now got their own budget, they've got their own priorities, they've got their own strategy, it may give us an insight into, frankly, what a Labour government looks like. And what was interesting today is we did talk about very specific policies. We talked about you know, what's happening with the design review panel, and we briefly touched on the M&S decision, and we touched on lots of different things that will be of interest to all the planners listening. But we also touched about what the overall mission of the council is. And to me, it's actually very simple. It is, how do you connect the wealthier parts of the city with the historically more deprived parts of the city to ensure that there is less inequality and less division, I guess, between, you know, the nice parts of Westminster that have lots of money and lots of opportunity and those that don't. And I think they see their role as facilitating that across the board, you know, and everything from the planning process to the development process to just generally how they engage with businesses, their own suppliers at the council. It's all about how they can create opportunities for those parts of the borough that historically have been deprived. And, you know, I think it's a good thing, really, because this is what the industry is talking about. This is what all of our clients are talking about. And it's good to see a council being sort of proactive in trying to facilitate it.
I think you may have inadvertently stumbled across quite a useful sort of microcosm of the general election there. And, you know, what a Labour government looks like. Westminster are dealing with a lot of the problems that, you know, are true across the country, right? There's a housing crisis, there's a cost of living crisis. You know, you've got a new Labour administration coming in after a long period in opposition.
What I would say is it's fundamentally a conservative solution. It's tying up the private sector with its private business being tied up with the needs of the community without spending any taxpayer money on it and connecting the two so that there's opportunity. I mean,
you're back to being a cabinet member on the doing a morning round.
It's actually a very sensible, pragmatic thing to do that's not costing huge amounts of taxpayer money. Anyway, enough from us. We'll get on with the interview. And I hope everyone enjoys it. Well, I'm delighted to be joined by not one, but two of the senior political leadership at Westminster City Council. We have Councillor Tim Rocker, Deputy Leader and Cabinet Member for Young People, Culture and Learning, and Councillor Jeff Barraclough, Cabinet Member for Planning and Economic Development. Welcome to the podcast.
Well, thanks for having us.
Good to see you. So we're 1 year in, just over 1 year in now, to the new administration.
And it's probably fair to say that the first year, you know, you inherited somebody else's budget, a bit of bedding into the role, new portfolios, etc. And I imagine it takes a while to get your head around all the different things that this major council does. But yeah, how have you found the first year? I mean, you've had a flurry of announcements recently, and now it's onto your priorities. But what would you say biggest surprise, challenge, and achievement is? I suppose.
Well, it's been a really, really exciting and innovating 12 months. You know, we spent some of us many years in opposition, so to finally get our chance to get our hands on the levers of power was a great opportunity to serve the residents that we represent. What really helped us, though, was that the leader made sure that we had, I think, probably the most extensive manifesto of any local Labour group in Greater London, at least. And so we had quite a detailed plan that each of us as cabinet members could jump into.
I think it was downloaded about 5,000 times the day after the election as everyone figured out what was going to happen next.
Mainly by people working at City Hall. that was, as Tim was saying, really helpful, because when we arrived in City Hall on the Monday, the officers had already started tabulating the things in the manifesto and what was going to be easy, what was going to be difficult, what was going to cost money, and so on. But, I mean, we'd taken a bit of a magpie approach on looking at best practice from the neighbouring boroughs, from Camden, Lambeth and so on. So there wasn't much in there that was going to scare anybody. It was all like best practice had been done somewhere else, so should be relatively easy to import into Westminster, which, you know, we're hoping to make a London borough which is operating as effectively as other London boroughs.
It's like a mini government department, isn't it, in a way? It's not like other local authorities. There's so many different strands and things going on the whole time. So many interested people. It almost has the same lens on it.
Yeah, but I think councils generally are slightly bonkers places because the breadth of services that they look after, you know, from Jess portfolio through to adult social care, there's so much that they're responsible for doing. But the thing about the manifesto that struck me, as well as it being detailed, was it was principally written over the winter just before the election happened. And then we went into 2022 with the war in Ukraine and the escalating cost of living crisis. And that didn't derail what we were trying to do, but it created a different backdrop to what we expected.
So, surprises, now you're starting to put that manifesto into action. Any major things you've had to take out because of that change in context, or anything you're really happy that you've kept in and made a sort of flagship?
There's nothing we've had to take out of the manifesto so far, and it's a four-year programme, so there's still loads to get on and doing. I think for me, the thing that surprised me most was us getting to grips, as I say, with the cost of living crisis. So we had a really positive message about building a fairer Westminster, and maybe Jeff will talk at some point about the plan that he unveiled the other week. But the backdrop was one where 10,000 households were particularly vulnerable to fluctuations in inflation. We've seen rents from two-bedroom flat in the city go up 26% in a year. So we were quite conscious that we had to act quite quickly to support those people in what was quite a difficult situation. So free school meals didn't appear in our manifesto, but it was something we felt was the right thing to do and quite an effective way of helping a number of families and households across the city quickly.
So how does it work with your role as deputy leader? Obviously, that's quite a big brief. You've then got a big brief on top of that with young people, culture and learning. How do you sort of split your time? What does the day job look like?
Well, it is incredibly varied, of course it is, but being deputy leader is more about supporting the leader in general terms across the council. And what's been really exciting in the first year of doing that is setting up the systems and the mechanisms whereby we as a political administration interact with the officers, who are all very, very capable. We're very lucky with the group of officers that we inherited, and making sure that we're working hand in glove instead of coming in as a bulldozer, sort of charging our way through, but instead being quite mature. And I think the example we set at the beginning as a political administration was saying, we know that we're new, we know that we don't know everything, we want to work in partnership with the officers, bearing in mind we are the strategic leadership of the authority, to get stuff done on behalf of our communities.
Yeah, and this is evolution, not revolution. So we weren't throwing away everything that had gone before. We were trying to build on it, to deliver all the things people like about living in Westminster, clean streets, low council tax, but also a measure of social justice as well.
And Jeff, do you feel like you've become an expert in all things planning in the last year?
No, it's the more I know, the less I know. I was on the planning committee for 4 years, and I'm now about a year or so into the more of the policy side of things. Yeah, because people do stop me as I'm walking down the street and say, "Jeff, can you let me know whether I can have this extension or not?" And I'm like, "Well, actually, people do a master's degree just to get into the junior level posts in our planning team. So,
yeah.
We really have to refer that to people who are much better qualified than me." The public policy angle of it is massively complex, and we've seen a huge number of consultations also from government, which we've responded to, and many of your clients and other local authorities have done that as well. We may come onto this, but it would be good to see some clarity from government on what actually it's going to do.
Yeah, I think we'd all welcome a bit of clarity on that front, to be honest. But let's see what comes out in the next few weeks. But thinking about policies closer to Westminster then. So we've had the Future of Westminster Commission report, that flagship commission that you set up at the beginning, which was quite sensible to, as an external force, to sort of answer some of these big questions and, I guess, contextualise the manifesto and put some detail on it. The Fairer Westminster strategy launch and the Fairer Economy launch. And, of course, the social impact report that we'll talk a little bit more about shortly. So there's quite a bit of detail that I think demonstrates where things are heading, where you'd like them to go. But what's that approach? Tim, maybe you can speak about the wider Westminster Fairer strategy, and then Jeff, get into the specifics of the economy aspect of it.
Well, I mean, it's a cliched term, but Westminster's always been talked about in the sense of being a tale of two cities, and for sure in the north of the borough in particular, although there are pockets across the whole of Westminster of entrenched deprivation, there is a particularly large focus on parts of North Westminster in the North Paddington programme, specifically because the issues there have been so long-standing. So we were determined that we were going to launch a strategy that looked at all the different factors that fed into that, including education, including skills, the economy, the structure of the economy, but also housing. I feel that housing is one of the keys to unlocking a lot of the challenges that exist in the city, and that's what a lot of the strategies that we're focusing on are about. So very, very quickly, working with the GLA and with Sadiq Khan, we were able to unlock, I think it was £90 million, Matt Noble was saying, in additional funds because we launched residence ballots on the two large regen schemes, Ebury Bridge being the one closest that I'm looking out the window of at right now. And that meant that we were then able to reprofile some schemes and make sure that we were building more council houses, in effect, which is absolutely crucial. So that was a big win for us as a new administration.
And on the Fairer Economy stuff, Jeff?
Well,
I guess it's all tied together, really.
It is all tied together. We launched this a couple of weeks ago. Westminster had never had an economy strategy before. It's a new, pretty much every other borough in Britain would have an economy strategy. But I think there was a view that central London would look after itself.
Mm.
And I think we learned during the pandemic that that complex ecosystem of retail, office market, leisure, culture, tourism all depends on each other and does need some policy and strategic support from the council and other public bodies to keep it humming. But also, as Tim was mentioning, that doesn't necessarily reach all parts of the borough.
Mm.
Westminster's got 250,000 people. There are areas where a quarter of adults don't have any formal skills. There are wards where we've got 10% youth unemployment. We've also got areas where there's no youth unemployment. So trying to find a way of matching up the demand for skilled labour in the centre of town, and the thing employers tell me that's most difficult at the moment is recruiting people, with the people who live here, who would value the well-paid, fulfilling jobs with careers that exist. So the economy plan is really about matching up the supply and demand, but also helping our small businesses, particularly in the context of local high streets, to thrive and or survive and thrive in what's been a very changing environment for SMEs, particularly those that trade on high streets.
Absolutely. So matching up the most innovative businesses, and you know we've got that in Westminster for sure, entrepreneurs and all of that, with the younger perhaps more deprived parts of the borough is the objective, basically. If you manage to achieve that over the next 4 years, you'll be very happy and happy to take that back to the electorate and say, let's continue to do it.
Mm. Well, the fundamentals are all there. So you've got, as you say, really impressive, innovative businesses. You've got really impressive schools as well. 95% of our schools locally are good or outstanding. And what we're hoping is through the plan, through the Education and Skills Board, bringing employers and education providers together, we'll actually get to grips with the issue itself. I mean, we don't have all the answers. That's why we're relying on partners to bring their points of view to the table. But I think if we've got these building blocks in place, we've got a really good shot at achieving some real progress in those entrenched issues.
So a good example being the Creative Enterprise Zone, which was announced last week. So we're one of North Paddington, we'll come on to in a moment, is one of three new London Creative Enterprise Zones. That gets a bit of money, but it also gets a brand that we can use. And it links us in with partners in the centre of town, Somerset House being a very good example, that we can use to bring mentorship and bring a bit of money, some ideas to link our residents and small businesses and charities and schools that have tremendous creative skills with, actually, here's how you can make a living out of this.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point, because for so long, I mean, we've always had, you know, just speaking from the point of view of all of our clients in the development industry, you go in for a planning application and you know, I would say that 90% of our clients do try and deliver some social value and social good as part of that process. But very often it's, we're creating XYZ hospitality jobs, or, you know, during the construction phase, we might be able to get 10 people from Westminster to help out on the site. And actually, that's not creating necessarily these really highly skilled, well-paid jobs for people that will then work in these buildings for the future. And I guess, Tim, your young people portfolio,
yeah,
I mean, how do we necessarily get businesses and developers and others to think about highly skilled jobs, not just those easy, I wouldn't say easy, but kind of, you know, let's get 10 people locally to work in the restaurant.
I mean, yeah, and it's not just businesses, it's the creative sector that we have, or the cultural sector that we have in the city as well. So as well as bringing young people to businesses, bringing young people to creative organisations or cultural organisations, using the City Lions program that sort of ties young people into the National Gallery, theatres. We also want our STEM subjects to be going into schools as well. We've got a change maker challenge that happened the other week where we're linking up entrepreneurs with schools and showing young people how it's done. We've then had them taking that practice out into our marketplaces and selling stuff that they've created and putting their business ideas into practice. But these things take time and effort, but they also need energy. And I think we've got the energy now and the focus, but we need to go beyond the sort of Dragon's Den style approach that perhaps we've had in the past and create meaningful connections. And businesses in the area want to do that. There's the Responsible Business Network that work with us quite closely, and there's an appetite to get more involved with Westminster schools.
So Jeff, I mean, putting that into the context of planning and development slightly, because I agree, I think businesses definitely want to do this. I think developers are getting there. How do, at the very start of a project, we get developers to focus on that kind of offer? Do they work with the team here at Westminster to say, look, we're thinking about putting a planning application in and we want to talk about how we might be able to do something really good for the community as part of that?
Well, I think the answer is a part yes.
Mm.
The key thing about a planning application is land use and what happens in the building itself, and you can't get around that with a bit of social value on the side.
I'm not saying it's a trade-off, but
we have something called the Responsible Business Network, which is a forum for businesses, primarily in the construction property sector, but also tends to be the key suppliers to the council, like Capita and Veolia and so on. And it has a brokerage function, so it finds community groups that can benefit from the skills and experience of the businesses. And a good example I would use is we don't want the management of these large organisations to be clearing waste out of the canal. We'd much rather they were in schools mentoring kids and doing careers advice and helping people. So that's the mechanism. I appreciate that, you're coming from a development perspective, but I really want to widen that network to include finance and media and tech as well, because we've got lots of other great employers in the city. We'd like to be able to help to deliver their social value programs, but locally.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair enough. I mean, and this sort of neatly fits into the social impact report that you launched last week, talking, you know, actually quantifying some of this stuff. I mean, I think this social value maybe needs to be described to a lot of people in the industry as whatever. I mean, it's bandied around so much. I think some people misuse the term. Some people don't understand fully what it means. What does it mean to you, and why is that report important?
Well, so to me, it has to be something practical, because you're right. A lot of buzzwords do fly around, but practically, how many jobs are we creating for the local community? How many hours of high quality volunteering are we providing? How many community groups are we supporting? And how much spending power are we redirecting into local small businesses as well? And that's what we went back to all the generally the property folk and the council's own suppliers, which is part of this network, to enumerate what those actually were in practical terms. Now, obviously, that gives us a baseline to say, well, actually, guys, I think we can do better. But in terms of sustainability, which is a major plank, I think, of pretty much every property developer's mantra at the moment, that doesn't finish when the building is completed. It needs to go on. And I was... At the launch, the developer of 105 Victoria Street, which is just across the road from us today, was saying that he was going to make sure the occupants of the building continued the programs that he had set up in constructing the building. And I think that's the kind of longer term thinking and commitment we'd love to see more of.
Yeah, so it's almost developers as well writing into the leases of the tenants that then end up in there to actually say, you've got to continue this program and it's got to have longevity.
Absolutely, it's the sustainable city, right?
Yeah, and I think actually, you know, businesses are heading in this direction, the developers are heading in this direction. It's almost tying it together and, you know, doing it in a way that is useful to business as well, so that it's not kind of with all the challenges that they're facing at the same time. I mean, this can help business, I think, is the point. It's not something that's meant to be difficult or additional cost, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, it needs to... For business to thrive, society has to thrive. They're two parts of the same coin.
Mm-hmm.
And a thriving society is one where everybody has a fair chance of success. But equally, businesses need workers. Workers need businesses. And everybody in the city is working, right? The unemployment's still relatively low.
Yeah.
The thing is, a lot of our residents are working very hard in jobs that don't pay very much.
Yeah.
And certainly don't pay enough to fund a reasonable lifestyle in central London. So at the same time as all the businesses are saying, you know, we can't recruit people, there's definitely work to be done there. We are about to advertise for the chair of our first Employment and Skills Board. So there's an organisation being set up which will bring together employers, training providers, the council and others. We want to hire the chair from the private sector. So adverts will be going out shortly. If you know anybody, please get them to apply. Again, every other borough pretty much has one of these.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? When you were talking about it at the launch, about, you know, what that can actually achieve, it's surprising that Westminster hasn't had one.
It is surprising, but I think it goes back to a feeling that, you know, central London would just kind of look after itself. And it does to some extent, but not to an extent that we're satisfied with.
So let's talk about the High Streets programme then. You mentioned it earlier. And, you know, I know this has been a priority for the whole council since you won the election, that it's not just about the West End, although we'll talk about Oxford Street in a minute. It's about other high streets in the borough and, you know, actually particularly places where I've lived in the past, but also, you know, where you have represented. What is that hoping to achieve? And obviously it's got a reasonable amount of money behind it as well.
Well, I mean, outside the West End, I think we have 30 neighbourhood high streets in Westminster. So it's
Can you name them all?
You know, I probably can. And I think people feel very fondly attached to their local high streets as a kind of barometer, an indicator of the health, the local economy and where they live. And when they begin to get either vacant units or they get low-quality occupants and they're not providing what people need, I think that just makes the whole area drop a bit in energy and happiness and well-being. So we've begun by a pilot scheme looking at a particular area, which is around Paddington and Edgware Road, where there's a concentration of underperforming high streets, but also a lot of people living there who could be spending money. And we're asking both the traders and the residents and the visitors what they like, what they don't like. And we finished a 3-week programme of engagement. We had 3 pop-up stores, 1 in each 3 high streets. And out of that, during the course of the rest of the year, we'll be specifying some projects with our £10 million fund that can hopefully shift the dial a little bit. So there's some greening projects, maybe some traffic projects, maybe some branding, maybe some loyalty schemes, maybe some shop fronts, maybe some training for the traders. Interestingly, when we looked at Harrow Road, which is we're a year ahead on Harrow Road, there are 230 units on Harrow Road.
Is that right?
Yeah. There's no clothing shops.
Really?
There's no financial services. There's pretty much nowhere to sit down and have a meal after 6 o'clock in the evening.
What's the majority use?
There's a lot of grocery.
Yeah.
And a lot of a lot of hardware stores. So there's probably some opportunities to work with the traders to say, actually, we think there's a gap in the market if you changed your offer a little bit. But what the single thing they've come back to us and said that they would like is access to capital.
Mm.
So a lot of times we were expecting people to talk about maybe car parking or, you know, but actually, I need to buy some stock. I want to transform my shop. How do I get the money?
Yeah. Yeah, that investment piece. And Tim, are young people involved in this process? Are schools involved in the consultation? Is it, you know, how does this, you know, walking around Harrow Road as a young person is very different from walking around Harrow Road if you're, you know, middle-aged looking for a meal after 6 o'clock, as we just discussed.
No, it's true. So one of the things that we said that we'd do a bit better was make sure that we were engaging with young people. So we've got 2 fantastic youth members of Parliament who are from different parts of the city, who bring a really, really good perspective. The consultation mechanisms that we've set up, I think, with the North Paddington programme are really positive in terms of bringing different groups on board from all backgrounds and all ages. But there's more that we need to do. We have a youth council that meets upstairs every Monday, but we want to broaden the representation there is on that. But, I mean, you'd expect me to say this being my brief. Young people have had a really raw deal in recent years, particularly with the pandemic. And sadly, the stats, not just in Westminster, but across the city, are going in the wrong direction. So more and more young people are dealing with obesity. More and more young people are dealing with mental health issues. A quarter of young people in the borough are in poverty. So this is what this all feeds into, building that fairer economy, making sure that the fundamentals are in place in terms of supporting them and helping them to get on. But we don't want to be doing that to young people. We want them to be part of the process and feeding in. And I think we've got more to go on that, but that has started.
I guess it's re-establishing that element of trust as well, potentially been ignored for quite some time, maybe not engaged in the right way.
I think so. I mean, youth services across the country were slashed, but they were particularly hard hit here in Westminster. We ended up with effectively a charity being set up, and a lot of the old responsibilities the council had transferred to them. We've put a lot of money into youth services in the last year, partly as a result of the cost of living crisis, but partly because it's just the right thing to do. So last summer, we spent an additional £250,000 on youth services, and that was like drama clubs, boxing clubs, more sporting activities, an opportunity to get a bite to eat whilst you were doing those things as well to help families. And I think there are about 2,500 kids access to that offer, which is good. But we're going to build on that and invest more in our youth clubs and youth services. But inflation is eroding the investments that we're making, which is making things more difficult. So we know that the energy costs for one of our largest youth clubs in the north of the borough has gone from £12,000 a year to nearly £60,000 a year. So these are the challenges we're all contending with, both in the private sector and in the public sector.
Yeah. And did the Commission look at this particular area, the Westminster Commission, and make some recommendations on how best to maybe assist, you know, to better young people's lives?
Well, if you've not seen it, and I'd highly recommend people look at it, the number of recommendations in the report is outstanding.
Sizable, isn't it?
Unsurprisingly, a lot of them are around more investment, and I think that is made more challenging because of the increase in costs. But if you actually look at stuff like early years, it's an investment that pays off in the long run. And actually, that's something that Westminster, even before the change of administration, was quite good at doing, was investing in early years, and therefore, I think, in the long run, saving money later on compared to other authorities. So we'll carry on doing that.
And I would highlight we have some young councillors. So the new intake of councillors is more diverse in its age group,
yep,
amongst other axes of diversity. And it's been, I think, really interesting and helpful having young councillors in the room when we discuss some of the issues that we're faced with. It gives a different perspective. People who are renting, people who are under 25, I mean, have a different view.
Yep, different challenges. Okay, Jeff, let's do a quick fire round on planning policy, just so that we don't bore Tim too much on this. But I've got to ask you while I'm here. So, firstly, Oxford Street consultation.
So that launched today,
yep.
or yesterday, depending on when you're listening to this. It could even be launched
2 months ago.
So we launched the full consultation on our stage one designs. It's an enormous piece of work by the team. They've done a terrific job. It hasn't come out of the blue. We've been engaging with residents and business groups over the course of the last 6 months. So hopefully nothing in there is a surprise. But there's a lot of detail in terms of, you know, where are the stop lines going to go and where are the loading bays going to go and so on. So, I mean, please, if you live, shop, work locally, look through it and let us know what you're thinking.
Very good. And hopefully it happens this time. It doesn't get stuck and all sorts.
Well, it should do. I mean, the key risk is funding.
Yeah.
So we need the private sector to make a significant contribution to the funding. All the indications are at the moment that they will. But clearly, until we get signature on a bit of paper, there's always a bit of risk. Always a bit of risk around that, but yeah, the moment it's looking reasonably positive.
Very good. Okay, design review panel. When's it happening?
So we've appointed the panel.
Yeah.
That will be announced very shortly, or was announced not long ago, depending again when you're listening to this, and we'll kick in the autumn.
Okay.
So I think major applications coming through from around September, October time would have the option to be reviewed by the DRP. Again, every other council, apart from the City of London, all the other 31 boroughs have one of these things. Again, it's slightly surprising that Westminster hadn't got one, but hopefully it will help us get the third leg of governance, me, policy, Councillor Ruth Bush, Chair of the Planning, and then a DRP gives you three legs of the stool that should ensure we get. I mean, clearly, no one's going to get everything they want out of the system, and people are still going to disagree with decisions, but they'll be arrived at in a fair and transparent format with good governance.
Yeah, and hopefully all three agree, and then it makes the whole process much smoother.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean...
or four, we should say, the applicant.
Yeah.
Okay, the retro first fee demolition debate, this is the most controversial subject in Westminster at the moment. Lots of applications sort of stuck with this issue and how to determine it. Do you see a resolution soon? Obviously, you've recently consulted on the policy.
So we're going to bring forward some draft policies in the autumn to consult on, which should give a more of a stepped process to deciding whether demolition's okay. And we're not, by the way, I'm just keep saying this, we're not going to have a you can't demolish buildings policy in Westminster. What we need is a much clearer guidance about, from a sustainability perspective, when it's okay and when we think it probably isn't okay. What we have seen is from the applicants, from the developers, much more interest in retrofitting. We've seen some really good examples of older buildings being repurposed. I mean, clearly there's a level of facade removal and we want to go two stories higher and whatever. There's still stuff that needs to get done. But it's clear from the architecture profession, from the development industry, they're getting much better at this.
Mm.
And actually, it is cheaper and quicker to, if you can refurb that.
If you can do it,
if you can do it. I appreciate you won't always be able to do it.
Yeah. But no, I think the industry is well on board with it if it can be done, because, not least because it saves so much time. Preparing additional reports and all the rest of it, that, you know, it can just be endless.
But in general terms, it is quite quiet at the moment. So the volume of major applications, it fell roughly in a half when Brexit happened, and it's fallen roughly in a half after COVID. And so it is quiet at the moment. I think the retrofit is...
I'm not sure planning officers would want you to say that.
Well, at the same time, the applications may have got four times more complicated, right?
Yeah, so yeah, yeah. It's trying to do a lot more.
Change. But part of that may be to do with... rethinking around retrofitting, but I think a fair bit is to do with the economy and interest rates. Right?
Yeah, I mean, it's just causing chaos. Last two, affordable housing SPD.
I've got it on my emails to approve.
It's happening just after this. There you go. Okay.
So that has to go up, I think, for a final 6-week consultation, and that's imminent if I push the button.
Okay, very good. And statement of community involvement is done and happening soon, according to your last report, I think.
Yes, and I think I may have approved that yesterday.
Oh, well, there you go. It's coming out very soon. Final thing, M&S decision. Any comment on that? It's expected this week, or it's expected last week, depending on when you're listening to this.
Let's come back when that's landed.
We'll do a whole session on interrogating that.
Well, I mean, whichever way it goes, I think there's definitely a half-hour podcast on it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, let's do it. Maybe we can get some other architects. Maybe Tim's not interested in that one at all. Okay. Look, well, there's so much more we could talk about, but let's. I just want to ask you a couple of things, because I'm hoping that there are some important people that listen to this podcast, like the Mayor of London and maybe some members of government, but maybe that's wishful thinking. What would your ask for Sadiq or the next Mayor of London and the government be to improve what you are trying to achieve in Westminster? Let's start with the Mayor.
With the Mayor?
Yeah.
I think the Mayor should carry on doing what he's doing. It's been a real, and you'd expect me to say,
I was going to say, I'm totally shocked that you would say that.
Being totally biased here, but it's been really one of the few things in recent years that has kept me slightly sane in politics in this country, bearing how unstable it's been, has been the stability of Sadiq Mayor's mayoralty and the maturity with which he's approaching stuff. Because we can't carry on with the amateur theatrics that we see down the road from here in Parliament. So that's what I'd say about the Mayor.
And I will give a much more prosaic public realm response, which is I think we should look at Marble Arch and Park Lane.
Maybe a mountain.
No, well, I think maybe not an artificial mountain, but there's some ideas around unwinding the gyratory at Marble Arch,
yeah,
and attaching the space where the Marble Arch is onto Oxford Street and creating a plaza.
Yeah.
Might be a great project to honour the memory of Her Late Majesty. And that leads you onto Park Lane, which is 6 lanes.
Yeah.
It doesn't need to be 6 lanes. I think there's tremendous opportunities to use that space better. But this is in the realms of TfL.
And we'd
love to
cycle
help,
lanes,
yeah,
and all sorts.
All that sort of thing. But I think that, from a London perspective, that's the bit of Westminster I'd love them to take a look at.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there you go. If you're listening. And what about the government then? Other than the fact that, and this is a genuine point, maybe Jeff on planning, but Tim more generally, is, you know, the election's going to be in some, you know, October next year, probably, we all know that. But in the course of time, people will be coming up with what their policies are going to be for government. What do you need in planning terms or generally? Other than money, because you're not allowed to spend any more money.
Not allowed to spend it. Well, the expectation management from the Labour front bench has been very impressive. But, you know, there's a serious point to this, which is, so Westminster's spending power has declined by 31% since 2010. And we're starting to see that feed into, you know, the low-hanging fruit of savings was taken a long time ago, yeah, across local government. So we are now starting to see a real effect on frontline services. And in children's services, we're having to make really difficult decisions, and we'll have to continue to do that. And there are other authorities up and down the country that are talking about closing leisure centres or what have you. So, you know, what we hope from a new government is that there will be a fairer spending outcome for local government, and a recognition of how important local government services are.
Mm.
And in planning, if I could ask one thing, it would be for us to be able to charge fairly for the services we provide.
Yeah.
On the way in, I talked to one of our officers going to meet a big developer who's putting some non-material amendments on a very large scheme. We get paid £220 for that.
Yeah.
That doesn't in any way recompense the time it costs us to spend, and that developer could happily spend a lot more money, wouldn't even notice it. So listed building consent, we really need to get paid for listed building consent. There's need to be a law, and you get something.
Yeah, yeah. And I think developers would be up for paying for it as well, to be honest with you. I think everyone recognises planning departments are not funded in the way that they need to be.
No, and what we need also from the national regime is a recognition that one size does not fit all. There's a national question of how we deliver large-scale housing in the suburbs and on agricultural land and throughout the nation. We just need to make sure that doesn't have inadvertent consequences on central London, where all the land, unless you're going to build on Hyde Park, which we really would not recommend, the land's already built.
That brings me to my next meeting. Brilliant. Okay, well, I think we should probably leave it there. I could talk for hours about all sorts of things, but thank you both so much for your time. And
thank you.
Tim, Jeff, see you soon. Thanks a lot.
Well, that's it from us. Thanks for listening to another episode of Better Places. Hope you enjoyed it, and we'll be back for another one after the summer. Have a good summer, everyone.
Lovely to see you.
See you later. Bye. 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 Bye.
Bye.